I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. Philadelphia has more than 3,000 miles of water mains, and some of those pipes are very old. In the last 2 weeks, there have been 4 major breaks causing flooding problems in several neighborhoods. Philadelphia is not the only city in Pennsylvania, for that matter in the country, that's struggling to manage its aging water infrastructure. And speaking of Pennsylvania and infrastructure, 4,800 of the state's 25,000 bridges are structurally deficient, and the roads have been called the worst in the nation. Well, today on Radio Times, the state of the region's infrastructure, and we have two guests who have joined us. Here in our Philadelphia studios is Dr. William Miller. He's an associate professor of civil and environmental engineering at Temple University. And Bill, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. Thanks for inviting me.
You're very welcome. And on the telephone is Dr. Peter Swan. He's an associate professor of logistics and operations management at Penn State at the Harrisburg campus. And Pete, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Hate to begin with a definition, but I think we need to do that to make sure our listeners know what we are talking about. And Pete, when we talk about infrastructure, what do we mean or what do you mean?
Well, to me, it's brick and mortar, roads, bridges, water mains, things that we've built that permit us to carry on with our lives.
And how about for you, Bill?
Yes, that covers it pretty well. I would also throw in there energy and communications, sort of the more abstract issues that we think about. Behind that is safety and economics. That's part of the overall structure.
As I was trying to think of a metaphor, and I don't know if this works or not, but I was thinking of the human body, and you think of the skeleton, you think of the blood, blood supply system. Is that, in a sense, what infrastructure is?
Yes, you think of the body as an overall system, and within that body there are subsystems, and they work within their own, as we define them, circulatory, nervous, skeletal, and so forth.
Does that work for you, Pete?
Oh, absolutely.
Let me go back to you, Pete Swan, and in preparation for the show, it's clear that we have serious infrastructure needs, and by that I mean we need to improve our roads and our bridges, dams, all the things that the two of you have been talking about. Why are they in such disrepair?
Well, the big reason they're in disrepair is we've been collecting less and less money to repair them. I think most telling statistic is if you look at all that the U.S. was paying for roads in terms of fuel taxes, excise taxes, it amounted to about 6 cents for every mile we traveled back in 1993, I think it was, 96. If you account for inflation and look at for the vehicle fuel efficiency, by 2005, we were paying 3 cents for every mile we traveled in real dollars. So it, basically, the amount of money for each mile we travel that goes to road maintenance and repair is about half of what it used to be back in 1996.
Is that because of fuel efficiency, or have we lowered those taxes?
Well, the thing about fuel taxes is most of them are fixed at a certain amount of cents per gallon. It's a little more complex than that, but basically, as the price of fuel goes up, the fuel tax typically remains the same, and the cost of maintaining roads goes up. And of course, the other thing is vehicles have gotten much more fuel efficient over time, so they consume fewer gallons of fuel for each mile that they travel. And all this means is that there's less and less money to maintain roads as we go forward.
Do you agree with that, Bill?
Yes. Although going in the other direction, when you have more and more traffic on the highways, there's more and more congestion. So that vehicles are traveling at a slower speed or idling and using fuel but not for any transportation purpose. So, yes, but generally that's the situation.
We spend most of our money, I guess, if we're talking about infrastructure on transportation. Is that correct?
Yes. If you look at the studies on infrastructure in terms of looking at the economic places where the money is placed by governments, for example, in the United States, it's approaching 45% infrastructure is targeted toward generally roads and highways.
And would you include public transportation in that?
Yes, but transit, railroads, shipping are a small percentage of that. The vast majority of it is highways. And, again, the way the federal highway legislation is organized, most of that, after the original system was built, is the purview of the states to do maintenance, repairs, and so forth. So there's a huge amount of money that goes into the upkeep of the system.
Let me go back to you. Yeah, Pete, go ahead.
Let me add something to that. One of the mistakes we made in creating the Federal Highway Fund for Roads for the building the interstates was it was set up to build the interstate system, and there was no allowance made for how we were going to maintain this system after it was built. Interstates typically last, you know, somewhere between 20 and 50 years. I think 20 is more like the lifetime, and then the system's wearing out. Well, under the thought originally was that states would maintain these roads without the idea that they'd have to be completely rebuilt, you know, every 20, 25 years. And the states have never, by and large, never accumulated the amount of money they would need to then rebuild the interstates. Meanwhile, we keep collecting this money for building the interstate system with no clear mandate of how to spend it for maintenance and how to allocate it to states for maintenance. And one of the reasons we've had trouble with earmarks is you know, when we set up this highway trust fund, we really didn't envision how we were going to use it after the interstate system was going to be built.
Hmm. And why does Pennsylvania get such bad marks when it comes to, I don't know if it's highways and roads, but when it comes to our road system, do you know, Bill?
Yes. In Pennsylvania, there's 40,000 miles of what we call state highways. But the state also has responsibility and ownership of over 70,000 miles of local highways. To me, that's an unusual situation for a state. So Pennsylvania has taken on that responsibility for a huge number of miles of highway maintenance, which you might not find in other states.
That's 110,000 miles of roadway.
Yes.
And highway. Is that how you see it, Pete?
Yep, yeah, and also a lot of bridges as well. We have a lot of roads and a lot of bridges in Pennsylvania, and we're falling behind in maintaining them.
And when a bridge, Pete, is called structurally deficient, what does that mean?
Well, that means there's some piece of the bridge, and Bill's probably going to be able to talk to this better than I can as a civil engineer, but either the substructure, the structure, or the deck that is not up to specifications and need of some repair. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean it's in imminent danger of collapse or anything like that, but there are repairs needed.
Go ahead, Bill.
Yes, if you consider highway bridges or railroad bridges in that also, there's two types. The bridges that go over a river have a particular problem because their enemy is the river itself, which is continuing to flow in all seasons, all velocities, all volumes. And a situation develops called bridge scour, where the actual foundation of the bridge is being eaten away by the water, which is the water's job in nature, is to eat things away, and it does a good job of that. So the biggest problem, at least in this area, is bridge scour. The other problem in general for bridges is, of course, that they're made out of steel and concrete, which are materials that will be, again, weathered by nature. Corrosion and other problems occur. And again, maintenance and painting. For example, the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco is painted continuously. They're never done. When they get done, they're back at the other end, and they just start over again. So it's that type of vigilance that's needed for these structures.
But when something is called deficient, does that mean that it needs to be repaired within a certain time period, for instance?
It could mean something simple as it's not been painted often enough, or there's rust appearing on the outside of it, or there are maybe some cracks in a particularly interesting place in concrete, and so forth.
One thing it typically does mean, though, is if those deficiencies aren't taken care of relatively quickly, the cost of maintaining the structure is probably going to be higher than it would have been as if instead of fixing it right away.
You know, I'm also thinking about that several weeks of just torrential rain that we had at the end of last summer, and all the bridges, especially some of these more rural bridges, that got washed away. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes. Okay. You'll see during flooding, particularly unusual flooding, bridges will be overtopped. They're not designed to handle that type of load. And the bridge itself and the approaches to the bridge, the land that makes up that can all be easily washed away. Mm. And the bridge has no chance in that case.
And Pete, has anyone figured out what it would cost? If we're focusing on Pennsylvania and its bridges, about almost 5,000 of them need of some kind of repair. What would something like that cost?
Well, I don't have the exact number in front of me, but the shortfall annually, I think, is around $3 billion for what we need to maintain our roads and bridges.
And that comes largely from the state?
Yes.
Does that seem to fit with you, Bill?
Yes.
So the idea, so we need $3 billion, and we're just talking about bridges now, right?
And this is extra.
And this is extra, beyond just the sort of regular maintenance.
Yes.
Yeah, bridges are difficult to maintain and replace because paving a highway is a fairly, let's say, lower cost, relatively speaking, than fixing a bridge, which is a much more technical type of job and is much more expensive.
Are there are there new materials that are being used, or even people thinking about smart bridges that, I don't know, might be able to repair themselves?
Well, in terms of smart bridges, there's been quite a lot of research done on putting sensors on bridges so that they can measure things like the vibration on bridges, the location of important pieces. Are they moving? Are they moving apart? Are they changing elevation? So, yes, there are smart bridges, but they're not common.
Yes. But is that the future, do you think?
Yes, although that's an expensive process, which could be perhaps better offset by putting the expense of that into more maintenance, better maintenance.
Just the kind of regular run-of-the-mill maintenance. Pete, go ahead.
You're still going to have a lifetime of a bridge, even with sensors and whatnot. I think Bill might confirm this around 50 years, typically, at which point you're either going to have to do a major rehab or a rebuild.
About 50 years.
Yeah, after 50 years, the bridge is probably under capacity. And could use a rebuild anyway, just for taking the load off and spreading it out, maybe over more lanes or that type of thing.
And this is not the first time we've talked about infrastructure. I remember talking with then Governor Ed Rendell, and he and Governor Schwarzenegger, if we can remember, from California, and Mayor Bloomberg in New York had talked about infrastructure, this crying need, not just in Pennsylvania, but across the country, for an investment in infrastructure. But we don't seem to have made a lot of progress.
Well, if you look at the history of infrastructure, there are lessons there. For example, when President Eisenhower was working on his goal of having the interstate highway system, his problem was funding it. And they eventually settled on what's called a user fee, but unfortunately today it's called a gasoline tax. So there's a political problem with that type of language. And as Dr. Swan said, that user fee was really fixed and this doesn't really apply today. So you have to look over the period of decades how society and other things change to where that perhaps that original concept maybe is a little bit outdated today.
Maybe a semantic difference might make the difference?
Yes.
Let's take a very Pete, hold on to that thought, only because we have to take a very short break, and we are talking about infrastructure today on Radio Times. In fact, investing in infrastructure. If you go back to the 20th century, a U.S. investment created a world-class system of roads and bridges, sewer systems, waterways, and much of this in desperate need of modernization. Talking with Dr. William Miller here in our Philadelphia studios, Associate Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering at Temple University. On the telephone is Dr. Peter Swan, Associate Professor of Logistics and Operations Management at Penn State at their Harrisburg campus. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Susan G. Komen, Central and South Jersey, supports WHYY and announces Race for the Cure, Sunday, September 30th at Six Flags Great Adventure. The event attracts 20,000 participants and spectators who join together in the fight against breast cancer. To register online, KomenCSNJ.org or 609-896-1201. That's 609-896-1201. Susan G. Komen, Central and South Jersey. Declare your pink.
We've called him the hardest working man in show business. Jack White has reinvigorated rock and roll with his bands The White Stripes, The Raconteurs, and The Dead Weather. He's produced albums by American music legends, launched a solo career, and founded a great record label along the way.
This week on Sound Opinions, Jack White speaks with Greg and me at Third Man Studios in Nashville.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
Swimming has been in the spotlight at the Olympics in London, but former Olympic hopeful Kelly Curran says she spent years in the shadows because of years of sexual abuse by her former swim coach. She says it's something that decades later still haunts her.
It's always there. It never goes away.
We'll talk about this next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscone. We are talking about rebuilding the countries, the states, the region's infrastructure, talking with Peter Swan and William Miller. If you have any questions or comments, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Pete, you wanted to add something. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, you know, I work with freight, and one of the problems freight has with infrastructure is it doesn't vote. People vote, and as you mentioned right now, people are voting to reduce taxes, and even though they're really kind of user charges, which is a different animal. But I think central to the problem we have with infrastructure, and this would apply to water mains, roads, bridges, is that generally people do not understand, first, what they're paying. Most of the people I talk to don't understand that the fuel tax is a fixed cents per gallon rather than a sales tax where you pay a certain percentage of the money you're paying to buy it. And secondly, most people don't understand where the money's going. I think there's a general perception that state departments of transportation are full of graft and do a terrible job, and that we'd all be better off if some private company came in and take over the functioning and everything would cost less. And unfortunately, you know, while there certainly is inefficiency at particular DOTs, just as there is in private industry, the real problem is not that. The real problem is that we just don't pay enough. There's not enough money to do the job. And I think until the public understands those two things, what they're paying and where the money's going, we're going to have a terrific problem in getting people to raise the user charges.
And Bill, often what inspires that kind of behavior is a crisis or an emergency.
Yes. I mentioned President Eisenhower earlier.
Yes.
And another crisis, there are several crises in history. First is the building of the Transcontinental Railroad occurred only because the battle between the northern and southern states in Congress over where to build the railroad ended with the states, southern states, seceding. So there's an accident of history which allowed a major infrastructure event to occur.
But I'm also thinking in the 50s, I mean, the highway system was built. Pennsylvania's, the turnpike is among the country's first.
Yes. There are two types of superhighways, as we may call them, that were built beginning in the 30s. First to be built were the private turnpikes, or the, you know, toll turnpikes in Pennsylvania, Kansas, and a variety of states that built these. And based on that model, after World War II, many of these were built before World War II, or at least started, President Eisenhower again had the vision to see a national system of four-lane highways. And this was based on his experience right at the end of World War II, where he was using the German Autobahn as part of the transportation system for, you know, post-war military and civilian activities for recovery. And
you'll find it.
Yeah.
It's right there in front of you.
At ease.
At ease.
Yes.
Good for you. I knew you would. Go ahead.
Now I'm at ease.
Yes, exactly.
In his book, he talks about his thinking about building highways, but at that time, the model for the federal, what we call federal highways, mm-hmm. or interstate roads, was two-lane systems. And he thought about the what he called the ribbons of the highways of the Autobahn as being his model for the interstate highway mm-hmm. system.
Interesting. Pete, going back to you, and you talk about private either construction or maintenance of roads, and I read about public-private partnerships. Is that a model going forward?
Well, certainly there are a lot of people putting that model forward. There's some of the conservative think tanks, like the Reason Foundation, would like to get the government out of infrastructure, public infrastructure entirely, and make it all private. To kind of put that in place, let me give you some figures. So if for a Pennsylvania citizen driving their car in Pennsylvania and filling with fuel in Pennsylvania, if you have a Camry like I do, you're paying about 2 cents a mile for every mile you drive. If you go on the Pennsylvania Turnpike, in addition to those 2 cents for gas, you're also paying 8 cents a mile in toll for the turnpike itself using an easy pass, which is pretty expensive. Ohio's 4 cents a mile for their turnpike, and Indiana's 3 cents. So one of the things that we've seen with privatization, especially of interstates, is the people who are going to run that would like to maximize their profit and put the toll up as high as they can to do that. Now, by agreement, they may not be able to raise it as high as they would want to, as the case of Indiana. But toll roads are generally significantly more expensive than what we're generally paying per mile for user charges.
You know, Bill, as you were talking about Eisenhower's experience in Europe after the war, I was in Croatia a couple of years ago after their war, and they had the most incredible highway system. There were very few cars, I have to say, on the road, went through mountains. I mean, just an unbelievable infrastructure that went pretty much the sort of north-south of the country.
Yes, people often use the example of Europe and nearby regions, Western Europe, for both transit and highway systems. The difference there is that you're dealing with a number of small countries. Larger countries such as Germany, Spain, France are probably the size of put together New York, Pennsylvania together. Mm-hmm. So these are larger regions. The model in the United States to do the same type of thing would be regional agreements among states to do this. So the scale is different in Europe.
Yeah.
Well, the other thing that's very different in Europe is the user charges. If you go to England or France and buy a U.S. gallon of gasoline, you're going to be paying $6, $8 a gallon. And the by and large, the bulk of that is going to be taxes that go both for roads and transit.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you, and that's Peter Swan. He's an associate professor of logistics and operations management at Penn State University at their Harrisburg campus. Also with us is William Miller, associate professor of civil and environmental engineering at Temple University here in Philadelphia. And we invited both of them to join us today in Radio Time to talk about the state of our infrastructure. We're talking about things like roads and bridges, and we can talk about sewer systems. That's certainly part of it, dams and water pipes as well. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Bill, let me go back to you only because in Philadelphia over the last 2 weeks there have been four water main breaks. A little bit of the reading that I've done is that's not wildly unusual, but nonetheless we have about 3,000 miles of main underneath this city, like most cities.
Yes. Historically, Philadelphia has one of the first what we would call modern systems. Of course, they're much more modern today, but at the end of the 19th century, Philadelphia had already installed a filtered water system, and that was the beginning of what's always been considered one of the major technically competent and proficient water departments in the country. But the age of the systems that were installed in some places in the city, there are 10-foot diameter sewers underground made out of entirely of bricks. Oh. And there will be some decay in that type of system. The age of the underground infrastructure is difficult to gauge. In the old days, they used to send people down there to crawl through sewers. Today, they use cameras. They use pressure testing. So there's quite a lot of technology that's being used locally to try to sniff out these types of problems. But the unpredictable, in some sense, is just the ground itself. You have groundwater running underground, and again, water is always trying to scour and take things from one place to another. So you may develop gaps between the pipe and the ground that's holding it up. Traffic on top of this, since this often occurs in streets, will put stresses on these pipes, and these stresses are cyclical, tire after tire after tire, and these types of stresses can cause a break.
Go ahead, Pete, and then we'll get to our callers. Yes.
The other thing that's happened in many urban environments is population has increased, and where the water mains haven't been replaced, the only way to get more water to the people who need it as the demand's gone up is to increase the pressure. And that's caused problems in some communities as well.
But there is this whole question of water management, just how literally do you manage water, especially in an urban environment where there's so many impervious surfaces?
Yes, and we look at water from a public health point of view as in two ways. One is the drinking water that's supplied to your house. Across the United States, about half of the residences still get well water. So drinking water is and the well water are tied in general use.
Right.
But in Philadelphia, you have drinking water delivered to your house. On the other side, you have the sewage that has to be taken away from the house. So we view that as two separate but related systems. The problem with the sewage side, which is the public health side and more directly, is that as more and more houses are built and streets are paved, thinking about from original uncovered ground, and large parking lots and large stores are built, and all this economic and residential development, the ground can no longer soak up the rain that falls on it.
Yeah,
and that water has to run somewhere.
Pete, you want to add to that? Then we'll get to our callers.
Well, one thing we haven't mentioned, the American Society of Civil Engineers gives a report card to infrastructure on a four-year basis. And, you know, bridges we talked about have been getting a C for quite a while. Roads have dropped. But in water, we're now at a D-, which is one of the areas that's one of the grades that's lowest. And one of the things they mentioned that hasn't come out in addition is that very few water systems have a battery or generator backup. So one of the real dangers we're running in this country is that as power infrastructure is not as dependable as it used to be, we may not have the ability to keep supplying people with water in the event of an emergency in many cities.
So we don't have enough energy, you're saying?
We don't have the redundancy we need in energy. You know, just like if you're in a phone company and the power goes out, you have an emergency generator that kicks in to keep the phone service up. We don't have that sort of redundancy in many of the water systems.
And if we have a D-, what does an F look like, Pete?
People are dying.
Really? And I know you were involved in public health, Bill.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Yes. There's an issue here of, I mentioned about water now has to flow across the surface of the ground because it can't infiltrate. It's referred to as urban flooding as a specific category of engineering. The water then has to go into a sewer and be taken to either to the river, but now that's being abandoned because that water is contaminated just from surface materials that fall off a car, for example, can be somewhat hazardous. And so that water now has to go to the sewage treatment plant along with the with wastewater from homes or what's called sanitary sewage.
Right.
The problem is, again, capacity. Putting all that water in the sewer is bringing the sewage treatment systems to capacity, and the question is, do we just build another system, or do we look at what I call the demand side, which is something that happened in the electricity industry in the 90s, where the demand side management is, well, let's look at how people are using this and then make more efficient use of electricity instead of building more power plants. Let's take the electricity, in this case the water runoff, and keep it on your property. Don't let the rainwater run into the sewer. And if you do, in Philadelphia today, you're charged a fee for doing that.
Oh, interesting. Well, let's get some callers in on the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. We have Andrew calling us from Center City, Philadelphia. Andrew, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Listen, I'd just like to ask the guest. I've traveled a fair amount, and I do agree with him absolutely. Pennsylvania has some of the worst roads in the country, bar none. But I've also traveled around the world, and I just was going to ask them, why aren't we making more use of technology in this country? And in particular, I'm thinking of Germany, where they have a GPS system that keeps track of trucks and charges them when they use the main highways without having to erect all of the toll booths and all the other infrastructure that you need to, but is able to provide money for their system. And it just seems we're a technological country. Why aren't we using technology more?
Well, it's a good question. I'm sure both of my guests want to take it. Bill, do you want to take it first?
Yes. Trucks do pay what are called user fees based on their economic activity. But I think Professor Swan might have something to say about this.
Go ahead, Pete.
Yeah, the beauty of what they're doing in Germany is the fee that's charged is not only based on the mileage from the GPS, but also the type of truck. So heavier trucks or more polluting trucks will pay more per mile than ones that are cleaner and lighter. We've done some experimentation with this sort of system. Oregon has done a very big study, and Minnesota has done some as well. However, freight companies are very reluctant to share exactly where their trucks are with the world on an ongoing basis. They're quite willing to do it periodically, but letting the competitors know or the government know exactly what they're doing is not something that a lot of people want to do. Publicly, there's also a lot of resistance to putting this sort of system on cars as well for the same reason, and there are many more people that are not wanting the government to know where they're driving than there are trucks as well.
But they use EasyPass, right?
They do, but you don't use EasyPass when you're off of the interstate.
Right.
EasyPass knows where you are when you're on their system.
Yeah.
I should also add there are a lot of toll roads that don't have toll booths at all, and I think that's what we're moving to in the future in the Pennsylvania Turnpike. You either have EasyPass or they take a photo of your license plate and send you a bill.
Is that a smart road, Bill?
Yes, that's a smart road from a economic or a toll collection point of view. Smart roads, particularly PennDOT, has other systems on the highway to measure the average speed of the vehicles through taking photos of license plates, but they promise they don't keep them.
Right.
And other systems that can indirectly look at the activity on the highway.
Why are we so stuck in the 20th century? I'm going back and forth between the two of you. Bill?
I think change has to occur usually on the basis of a crisis. If you look back at the 17th century when the big industry for oil was the whaling industry, that industry collapsed because the whales were taken beyond sustainability. And along about the same time, the Industrial Revolution was bringing about petroleum, which was originally used for lubrication, but then also looking at it as with new systems being invented, machines, the combustion engine, James Watt invented the boiler, steam boiler. These systems demanded a different type of fuel than whale oil, so there was an energy crisis on that basis.
But and I'll toss this to you, Pete. We're almost up in a break here, but we're in the internet age. Yes.
Yeah, but the fuel tax is the cheapest way to collect a user charge. It's much cheaper than EasyPass. It's cheaper than toll booths, and that's one of the reasons we haven't changed, at least as of yet.
Well, let's take that short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about infrastructure, investing in infrastructure. And if you look at Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Delaware, frankly, across the country, there is a crying need to update our systems of roads and bridges, sewer systems, waterways. And we're talking with Dr. Peter Swan. He's an associate professor of logistics and operations management at Penn State at the Harrisburg campus, and Dr. William Miller with us in our Philadelphia studios, associate professor of civil and environmental engineering. Give us a call, questions or comments, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Folk Festival proudly supports WHYY. This year's Folk Festival features Little Feat, John Hyatt and the Combo, Steve Earle and the Dukes, Trombone Shorty and Orleans Avenue, Lucinda Williams, Mike Cross, Mary Chapin Carpenter, and more at the Old Pool Farm near Schwanksville in Upper Salford Township, August 17th through the 19th. For a weekend of concerts, crafts, camping, and children's activities, the Philadelphia Folk Festival, 800-556-FOLK or folkfest.org.
There's this mystery man I've been chasing for the better part of a year. Cooks the purest meth that me or anyone else has ever seen.
That's Dean Norris as DEA agent Hank Schrader on AMC's Breaking Bad. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Dean Norris. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Thank you. Elite athletes in the Summer Games have dazzled us with their grit and amazing physical strength and skill. It takes a special mindset to prepare, compete, and persevere at many levels of athleticism. On the next Voices in the Family, the psychological side of sports. What's behind our passion to compete and desire to push our bodies so, and what holds us back or inspires us. Today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain. If you hear the word infrastructure, many people yawn and roll their eyes or maybe even change the channel. But if a bridge collapses or a highway buckles or a water main bursts, it is big news. There are billions, probably trillions of dollars in needed infrastructure spending to repair and replace the country's aging and ailing dams, water systems, highways, sewer systems, roads, and bridges. And in an increasingly global and competitive marketplace, infrastructure matters, and it can mean good jobs as well. That's what we're talking about with our guests, Peter Swan and William Miller, and also taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. So, Bill, I think we've kind of diagnosed the problem, and I think hopefully people listening, they didn't change the channel. They're hanging on our every word, is that we have to figure out how to invest in our infrastructure. Let's talk about some of the sort of future technologies that are probably here, including something called Next Gen.
Yes. For a number of years, the Federal Aviation Administration has been working on a system to upgrade the air traffic control system. The system that's still in use today primarily is a radar, a ground-based system, which has been around certainly since World War II. So, but most of us have either seen or have a GPS in our car. So why not that? Right. So the next gen is a satellite-based air traffic control system, which uses that type of technology, GPS technology. The differences will be that aircraft are currently spaced apart for safety purposes because the radar is a relatively slow reporting thing. GPS, the satellites, are instantaneous pretty much. So the air traffic control system can know where each airplane is in real time, and that way they can reduce the spacing between them. Another major thing, if you think about this, when you fly overseas, for example, often you're out of range of land-based radar, so you're just flying on, a spacing maybe 15, 20 minutes apart. But in this case, you will be able to have the location of that airplane just as if it was over land, and the spacing can be reduced in that system.
So GPS or technological fixes. Pete, do you want to put something on the table as well?
Well, not on the next gen for air.
How about something else? Just so we feel like, okay, we know the problem exists. What are we going to do about it?
Well, the thing that we had mentioned, GPS for collection of user charges for road, and I think that's coming down the pike. It's just, I think, a question of when to some extent. And the reason is many of the vehicles we'll be driving in the future will not be burning gasoline. They'll be burning natural gas, maybe hydrogen. Maybe they're electric cars that don't plug into any fuel source other than the power grid. How do we tax those? You know, how do you set the rates one versus the other? It opens up a whole can of worms. And at some point, we're going to have to switch to some system where people pay by the mile for the roads they use.
And I guess it's convincing people that it's a good investment, right, Pete?
Right. Well, and the big decision is, do we put a GPS where every car is tracked, or do we simply record the mileage so that when you go to the fuel pump, the car tells the fuel pump, I've driven 100 miles, mm-hmm. and it adds some tax onto the fuel bill.
And I do want to get to our callers at 1-888-477-9499. But let me take advantage of the fact that you're here, Bill, and we're in Philadelphia. And I know that the Water Department has been doing some interesting and, I would say, innovative things when it comes to stormwater management, dealing with this aging infrastructure.
Yes. Stormwater management is the response to the problems I mentioned earlier of urban flooding. There are regulations in the Water Department today which require residences to pay a fee if they put the roof water into the sewer. Mm-hmm. You cannot pay that fee if you put some system on your property, such as what is called a rain garden, which is a place where water will infiltrate really very easily. And if you can prove you're doing that, then they will remove the fee. The idea is that they don't want to build bigger sewers. They just want to put less water into sewers, because if you build big sewers, you got to build bigger sewage treatment plants. So there's a domino effect there.
I'm also thinking of green roofs and some of these new materials that you can use that absorb, absorb rainwater, for instance, or runoff.
In our department, we're doing undergraduate research and some graduate research on green roofs. There's a number of them around the city. The Pico building, for example, has a very nice one. And in these systems, what's happening is that the water is being retained on the building and allowed to come out of the system very slowly or simply evaporate, which is the best outcome.
Let me get, looks like Ken from New Jersey to join our conversation. And Ken, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, I often hear about infrastructure problems, and you always hear about roads and bridges, first of all, and that's important, but there's a lot of problems with really infrastructure, stuff underground, water, sewer, electric, gas, that needs a lot of repair or replacement, and we seem to not want to spend the money to do it. But, you know, I'm a master electrician, a master plumber, and I know for a fact that we spend more money on bottled water than we do on fixing, you know, water lines underground. And it seems sort of ridiculous to me that we haven't gotten up to speed on that.
Well, Ken, I'm sure both of our guests are happy that you called in to make your point. I appreciate that. Let me give Pete Swan a chance to weigh in.
Well, you know, just like we have a problem with the fuel tax not keeping up with inflation, we have the same problem with many of the water slash sewer fees in many towns. Even where you have private industry running the water or the sewer, you still typically have some sort of fixed fees. And one of the suggestions, ironically, that's been made is we ought to be taxing the disposable water bottles to help pay for the water and sewer improvements that are needed.
And people drink a lot of water out of water bottles. Go ahead, Bill.
Yes, the interesting regulatory view of bottled water versus tap water is that bottled water is regulated by the Food and Drug the Food and Drug Administration under soft drink regulations, which are much more lax than the EPA regulations on tap water. So that's one thing to keep in mind. Bottled water technically has a shelf life on it.
Hmm.
The shelf life of tap water is taken care of by the fact that the water is constantly circulating, and the water that's in the system is designed not to be more than 72 hours old.
Something to keep in mind, and I have to say something I didn't know. Let me put something to you, Pete, and I'm thinking, as we're talking about this, it's just a week or so after India lost electricity that affected, you know, hundreds of millions of people in that country, now a very different country from the United States. But I think a bit of a wake-up call about just the kind of, pressure on energy grids and things like that.
Right. Well, energy grids are kind of like one of the road segments we call connectors. And quite frequently, there isn't a single entity responsible for building and maintaining connectors, and it's a multiple responsibility sort of thing. And often they can be ignored for that reason. But it's a really messy issue, because one of the things you look at when California was having its terrible problems with power, one of the reasons was the power companies were shuffling the power around a lot more just to create a shortage in the worst case. But there's been a lot of talk about our power grid as well, and Bill can probably talk more about what's being done, but it's been a critical problem as well. I think India has some special economic problems we don't have, in that many people don't pay for power over there, and states, the particular states within India, draw more power than they're allotted. And so there's very loose or no control over how much is being used versus how much is being generated.
A lot of air conditioners running this summer, though, Bill. We've had all this high temperature.
Yes. The future in power industries is going to be the diversity of power sources. Pennsylvania and New York State, for example, are lucky, you might say, in the sense that they have a lot of hilly, mountainous territory. That's why they're ideal for establishing large wind farms. Pennsylvania has really devoted quite a bit of investment into that. New York State, I think, is doing that also. And these wind farms, even though they don't, they couldn't hope to generate all the electricity, are bringing up new systems to avoid having to build new fossil fuel or coal and so forth type power plants, because they're very expensive to build, and it's difficult to get investors to agree to a new one.
You should mention there's a revolution in power right now with the new EPA rules. When a power plant comes up for recertification, a coal power plant, very often it's either shut down or converted to natural gas. The price of natural gas in this country is so ridiculously cheap compared to coal that very few utilities are building any new coal plants or even recertifying existing ones.
And cleaner than coal?
Yes.
Including this thing called clean coal?
Well, that doesn't exist.
Okay, I was just running that by you. Let me get Zach from the Northeast to join us. And Zach, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, yeah, I was in China a few years ago, and the distance from Tianjin to Beijing was 2 hours. But they were building a high-speed rail system that would cut it down to 30 minutes, and that's sort of the distance from Philadelphia to New York. If we were able to establish a train system, a rail line that could go at that speed, that would definitely decrease, you know, congestions on the highways. Wouldn't that also decrease the cost of repairing some of the highways, or the necessity for smart highways?
Zach, I appreciate the call. And there's been some talk about a high-speed rail line. Let me see what Bill Miller has to say.
Yes, we talked a moment ago about aviation improving. Behind that is a larger crisis of how you use aviation. It's expensive. It's time-consuming in some aspects of getting on the airplane, for example. The problem with high-speed transportation in the U.S. is funding it. It has very little political support because it doesn't benefit very many states directly. And unless you develop some type of national system, the problem is that the funding in many European countries is part of the gasoline marketing system. In the United States, particularly in Pennsylvania, there is no dedicated funding for transit systems as opposed to highway development systems.
And Pete, if it were the Northeast Corridor, that's a pretty congested part of the United States.
Right. Well, Amtrak's done a decent job of taking a lot of people out of airplanes, especially the D.C. to New York market and even New York to Boston to some extent. And they do have plans for increasing the speed on the corridor. Talking about technology, it used to be trains could only go up to around 150 miles an hour and no faster because you got this wave motion with the catenary, where there's a new type of catenary out that lets you go very, very fast, as the Europeans and the Chinese and the Japanese are doing. But we have to replace almost the entire existing catenary system from D.C. up to New Haven. Costs a lot of money. There's various bridges that need to be upgraded. They cost a lot of money. If we're going to run faster trains, we need new power stations to feed the electric current into the wires. Massive investment. And as Bill mentioned, it's not clear there's the will to do it, although we are putting pieces in here and there. And I did see a plan to bring the speed up, I think, between D.C. and Baltimore up in the next 10 years or so. But it's a while away.
Zach, thanks for the call. Let's see what Colleen from Hatboro has to say. And Colleen, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Yes, I'm wondering why we don't mandate porous paving in these urban areas that are having such an infrastructure problem with water and sewer, or at least in the same way that we mandate new builders of, you know, large plots set aside open space. In the same way, we don't sort of tell them that they have to use this porous paving that recharges the groundwater.
Colleen, it's a good question. I'm going to toss it to Bill Miller.
Yes, that's another area that we do research in terms of porous pavement. The problem with porous pavement up to this point is that since you're leaving gaps in the mix of the pavement, or what we call the matrix, so that water can drip through it, it's not as strong as regular highway pavement. So you are limited in using those to perhaps in this area, the small streets in South Philadelphia, for example, where you don't have a high speed. You could not use it on high speed or places where you have heavy vehicles. It wouldn't last. It would break up. But it can be used in many other places, city streets. They, again, in the same neighborhood in South Philadelphia, they are installing street pavement in certain streets, which allow the water to drip directly into the groundwater and not have any runoff from storms.
And I would think that'd be pretty good for a city to have that because of those water management problems.
Yeah, you can do that for basketball courts, parking lots for stores, anything where you have slow, not very heavy vehicles, right, because they will last.
Pete, we have about a minute before we have to say goodbye here. I'm just curious, looking ahead, and I think we've done a pretty good job of outlining these various infrastructure challenges. How would you prioritize them, and what would you put on the top of the list of something we really need to look at and do something about?
Well, I don't think it's so much the infrastructure that there's any one thing we need to do above all others. I think we need to get the economics in line so that people are paying the true cost of the infrastructure they're using so we can maintain it, replace it as necessary. And also, what often gets ignored, people can make smarter decisions about which mode to travel, whether to use public transit, if they're paying the full cost with each of the choices they might use.
Do you see it as a cost issue, Bill?
Yes. It usually boils down to an economic issue. If you bring in what are called the social costs, which are sometimes difficult to measure, but which do have value in public health, it's people not getting sick. The value of that would be what you spend on that as a social cost. So avoiding transportation or having transportation or what's called intermodal choices, where people can let the market bear what is necessary through their own personal choices. That would be a good economic system.
Well, on that note, my thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Bill Miller, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Peter Swan, thank you very much as well.
Thank you.
And Peter Swan, Associate Professor of Logistics and Operations Management at Penn State at their Harrisburg campus, and William Miller, Associate Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering at Temple University. Appreciate those phone calls to Radio Times. You can also go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about this program. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you for joining us. Do stay with us for the second hour of Radio Times. We'll be right back.